Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics all the way through from year 8 to year 13.
And physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time, A-level mostly, teacher of physics. And we are joined by a third teacher of physics, friend of the podcast, Carol Kemrick.
Hello, I'm Carol. I am currently teaching part-time in an all-through school in East London. I teach year 6 up to year 10 at the moment, but I've previously taught in secondary and primary. I also work part-time for the Institute of Physics as a professional practice coach, supporting our colleagues, supporting physics teachers in schools, and also for the Ogden Trust, running CPD and again, supporting teachers. So physics teachers, yay, that's me.
You love them, we love them.
Okay, so we got in touch with you, Carol, because we have been building up to doing a podcast about writing and literacy in physics. We have a nice chat with Will Pope later, but we saw that you had done a talk about writing within a big project on literacy from the Science and Practice Network. But now I heard that's made up. It's another sort of ground roots organisation, Carol. Is that true?
So it's a bunch of science teachers who are all lovely, and they put on conversation series and they read books and discuss books together and think about their implications for their practice. And they put on their first conference recently, which was about literacy and science. And there were lots of people talking about all different aspects of literacy, but I specifically focused on writing.
That's another ground roots network like Chat Physics, isn't it, which are doing their conference as we record.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so talk to us about writing in physics.
First thing I might say is to just zoom out for a moment is to just emphasise that when we think about literacy, I think we often think about reading and writing, but it's also about oracy, which is speaking and listening. And a lot of the time, oracy is useful in of itself, but it also can be a really powerful scaffold for writing. So a lot of teachers will know about think, pair, share, and how actually giving students a bit of time to think and discuss before they write down an answer is really valuable. And that for good writing, you do kind of need the other aspects of literacy in place. So if students don't have strong vocabulary and knowledge of what the key words mean, and if they've not seen good examples of writing and read them, and if they've not heard good vocabulary used in practice and good modelling, then they're going to struggle to write. So even though I'm going to share things specifically to do with writing, I just want to emphasise that the others are also important. It's all kind of interconnected like a beautiful web. So I think the thing to say specifically about writing is I find it useful to distinguish between three different reasons why we might ask students to write, both for my planning, but also I share this with students because it then makes them understand why they're writing, what kind of writing is required, and who's the audience as well. I think the first type of writing that I might talk about is writing for learning, because that's the first step. Before you ask students to write an exam question, you would want them to see whether writing can be used to help structure their thinking. As we know in physics, there are a lot of ideas that are interconnected. We need to find ways to support students to make connections between the ideas and form these schema in their minds so that they can see, you know, these different situations all relate to, say, Newton's first law, even though they might look on the surface quite different. And writing can be good for that. So I don't know if you've come across storyboarding as a technique, but I find it really helpful for that. I model it in, I don't know if you've seen my charge and static video for the electricity IOP domains videos. I do a little bit of storyboarding in that. And the idea is you break down a situation or a scenario into the steps. For instance, the example I give in that video is to do with a balloon being rubbed on a jumper. So I might use the FET Colorado simulation. And I've got the steps of balloon and jumper before they're rubbed. And then after they've just been rubbed. And then when you bring the balloon near the jumper. So you've got three different steps there, which are to help them understand what's going on. You're just really breaking it down into these little chunks for analysis. So my first step with students would be to identify, well, what keywords might we use in our description? And so we would write down all the words. And I don't know if you've come across the idea of different tiers of vocabulary, tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier one is your everyday vocabulary. So cat, hat, house, the everyday words that you'd expect children, even from quite young age, to pick up. Tier two is specific academic but not specific to a subject. For instance, analysis is used in different subjects and it is specific. But then there are also the tier three words, which are words that are particular to your subject. So we wouldn't really use photosynthesis in physics, but equally biologists might not use momentum. As physics teachers, we often focus on the tier three vocab, which is the language that we know is a physics keyword. But actually, if students don't know what analyze means and describe means in the context of physics, then they're going to struggle as well. So I make sure to think about those words. And at that point, I say to students, we're going to ban the word it. Okay. If you say the word it, I'm going to pause you and I'm going to ask you to specify which of these keywords do you actually mean. If we're talking about electricity, I might also ban the word electricity because it is meaningless. And if there isn't a word in our keyword list that is adequate, then maybe we need to add another word. So that's the first step, is to kind of think, okay, well, what vocabulary do we need in place to describe the situation? And then step by step, we describe it. So I would annotate it on the board or under the visualizer and get students to do this as we go along and say, right, can you describe for me what's going on in this first picture? Right, there's a balloon. Our keyword, charge. Could someone use the word charge to describe what's going on? So I'm using the keyword list as a scaffold for their description. And then we annotate it and we go through the different steps.
I do this only in one example in my practice, which is I don't like the word amount and I forbid the word amount. And that you're forbidding the word it resonates with me. Not amount. What do you mean? Do you mean mass? Do you mean length? Do you mean charge? What do you mean? That's as far as I go, I'm afraid. So my CPD through the podcast continues.
That's good. That's a really good point. If there's a word that is almost like an umbrella hiding what you actually mean, then like, let's open it up. I don't think umbrella is the right term, but there's a word that's obfuscating, that's hiding what you actually are talking about. So once we've got our descriptions, I then would systematically go through the keyword list with them and say, right, have we used every single one of these words? And we literally go through, tick them off. If there are any words missing, this is where we then redraft. And the concept of redrafting is so important. And this is a really nice way to make it explicit and say, right, we haven't used the word positive. Could we add the word positive to any of our descriptions? And then we redraft and add as necessary until we've used all the keywords on our list. At that point, we've got this annotated multi-step diagram. Right, let's order the steps to see what's the logical order to describe them in. So first this happens, you know, you might have a few annotations on each drawing. So think about if you're trying to describe and explain something, we might start with a description and then the explanation for each section. And then once we've got the numbers, we can then write out a description. This, you're probably thinking, huh, that could be useful for exam questions too. And it is, but the point I'm making is the purpose isn't to get them to pass an exam. The purpose is to develop and structure their thinking and their understanding and make links between all these different ideas. So it's powerful in several ways. And if you're teaching chemistry and biology, this is also useful for those subjects. Because anything where there's a process, when I was teaching year 7 chemistry, distillation, evaporation, all of these things, it is so useful as well. So that would be my first tool that I would really recommend for developing students learning through writing, but which also helps them to then structure great answers later on down the line. But the point of it is not just to pass a test. For them, the motivation is to develop their understanding, which intrinsically is often more motivating.
So that's the first thing, writing for learning.
You started this off, it's one thing I wanted to emphasise, with the idea of oracy being almost the base for this. The students will find it much easier to express these ideas to each other through talk than they will to just cold write it down straight away. You preempt the whole process with that.
Absolutely. And so one other thing that's really good to do is to then ask students, once they've got their annotated diagram, is to then take it in turns to describe or explain to each other what is going on in the pictures. So often I found with students all the way up to A-level is they might write something that I look at and I'm like, that makes no sense. And they can't see that it doesn't make sense. But when I read it back to them, they're like, oh, miss, that doesn't make any sense. And so there's something about hearing it said aloud or hearing someone else say it that makes you spot the gaps and jumps that aren't logical.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's beautifully laid out and beautifully described. Thank you, Carol. So that's step one.
So that's one tool that I use a lot in my practice. And another is explaining mistakes, showing them a picture, for instance, with ray diagrams, where I find it's something students find really tricky, and they have to explain why there's a mistake in this diagram. So that's not just to get them to do well in an exam, but it's to get them to identify and think about why this doesn't make sense and how they could improve it. Another thing to do that I find really powerful is reflective writing. Now, this is particularly good for their motivation, but also is good for relationship building and for me getting to know my students, especially at the moment when I haven't been able to have individual conversations with them as I would normally. What I did at the start of the year is I asked them all to write me an introductory letter, and I provided a lot of guidance and scaffolding about what I expected to be in it. I wrote a letter to them and modelled step by step, this is going to be our first paragraph. And I wanted to find out how they felt about science, what they were excited about to do with science, previous science that they could remember, any career goals that they had, whether any of them related to science, and their interest in general and anything they thought I should know about as their physics teacher. And the other question I put in was, is there anything that you're worried about to do with science? And that was really, really incredible because I got to know so much about my students. And I found out one of my Year 9 girls wants to be an astronaut and work for NASA, which I would never have known otherwise because we've not had a chance to have one-to-one conversations this year at all. It's also given me a chance to think about what motivates them. And quite a lot of my Year 9 said that they were worried about being able to remember everything in science. And so that's been really good for me to be able to think about how I talk about, right, I'm going to teach you these revision techniques, or I'm, you know, using retrieval practice because it will help you. So I found ways to make them feel more confident and comfortable in science and knowing that I'm looking out for them. So that for me is an example of writing for learning because it's reflective writing for them that helps create more motivation and a culture in the classroom where I can support them. I also then ask them to write me a where are we at letter at the end of the term, reflecting on their progress since the start of the year. Again, that was just really insightful and really fascinating.
I love that idea. I wonder if it's too late in the year for me to dive in and get my lower sixth to write me a letter.
I don't think so. It makes sense to do it at the start of the year, but I don't think it's ever too late.
So that we talked about writing for learning, and lots of examples there, and opportunities for them to demonstrate their skills. You've told us before that then you have writing for remembering. So how does writing for remembering work? How is that different?
For me, writing for remembering is about how do we teach students to write notes that are useful and that help them remember what they need to remember, but also thinking about concept mapping and mind mapping that helps connect different ideas again. I came across a technique while I was doing research into supporting students with ADHD. Disclaimer, I have ADHD, so I've been using this technique myself, which is the SQ4R technique for reading. And a big part of it is about you scan the text and then you write questions about the text. And then as you read it, you write down your responses to the questions, then you read your answers aloud, and then you reflect on whether there's anything you still don't understand. By having notes that are in question and answer form, that means that students can then use their notes to quiz themselves later when they're carrying out their revision. And it means that if students go through the lesson and they're like, oh, there's a question I couldn't answer, or I didn't understand that answer as part of that like reflect part of the process, that's something I can then pick up on and support them with. And also giving, so for instance, with my Year 9s in particular, I've done a lot of work because of the nature of the class on supporting them with what's the point of notes, and wouldn't it help if we had diagrams and annotated them? And, you know, you might want to use a bit of color coding, but actually the important thing is that you've got your ideas in there and that it's your understanding. So I do a lot of co-constructing success criteria with them. With notes, for instance, our success criteria included things like, is it in my own words? Has it got diagrams to describe key points and make them memorable? Have I used mnemonics? Have I found a way to try and make it memorable to me, basically? And I do a lot of modelling note-taking under the visualizer or on the board, writing down keywords, expanding them, writing questions and all of that. At the moment, it's a bit tricky because of the online nature of learning. I'm very much I have thought in advance about what we're going to do and the things I'm going to draw and the points I'm going to make, and modelling and writing under a visualizer or now a graphics tablet or on the board. So it's a little bit of a mixture now. What I found actually really helpful to do, because it allows me to focus on making great notes with the students, is to find a really great video, play the video, and then pause it and say, right, what are the key points? Brilliant. Right, let's write them down. And I model that on the side, because I think it can be quite tricky to do that live, especially remotely. under a visualizer, making sure they can see everything and they can hear me and checking the chat box. For me, doing it live is much more powerful because you can then question as you go along and ask students, right, what should I write down? What was that? What are the key words that we've talked about so far? So I would have some explaining with modeling and then like, let's pause. What are the key points? Let's make sure we've got them written down. Make sure you've got them written down. But with younger students, I might provide scaffolds rather than fill in the gaps. It's more questions that they then answer whilst we go through the ideas in the lesson, or like a pie chart, and they have to fill in information and then do the analysis themselves.
So the third way you've told us for writing is writing for communication, which is the thing I think I would do a lot of, which is writing answers. So in preparation for that, I had a chat with Will Pope before Christmas. Still relevant, of course, so I'm going to play that in now.
Hello, I'm Will. I teach physics at a school in Surrey with GCSE and A-level. Boys at GCSE and then girls come in and join us for the sixth form for A-level.
Well, welcome to the podcast, Will. Thank you for contacting us. So you contacted us after we did our long answers episode, and you had shared with us and put on TES extended writing planning tasks. And it seemed to me that you appear to actually stand up and teach how to do extended writing, which is something I'm a bit scared to do. So can you tell me your thinking around that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I think my primary concern is I don't do this too early, because whilst I think literacy is really important and scientists need to be able to communicate well, at the same time, I don't want to be accused of teaching to the test. So I want to get as much physics learned as possible before, in the fifth form and the upper sixth, we look at writing questions which exam boards will like. And what I try and do is spend probably a half hour, 45 minute lesson hammering a technique into the pupils, which they hate for 45 minutes. And then I grotesquely over reward anyone who uses my method in subsequent homeworks and tests. And eventually they get it. And we're now at a point where pupils coming into the lower sixth for several years now have been using the techniques they learned in the fifth form, and the quality of their communication, I think, is really improving.
I have to ask you what a grotesque over-reward is.
We have a merit system at the school, and, you know, if someone writes anything that implies they've thought about my technique, I'll give them a merit, even if they get zero marks for it, because if their physics is completely wrong but their approach is all right, then that deserves a merit in my book.
Oh, I thought it was going to be something like a Cadbury's cream egg or something.
No, that'll cost money.
So I've had a look at your PowerPoint, and is the technique you're talking about stopping, thinking, and coming up with the points before you write?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I wouldn't expect them, when they're actually doing the paper in an exam, to do the whole method. But when we practice it, I get them to do it very, very slowly, and hopefully, even though they're not doing it fully, it'll then come out. And yeah, essentially it's thinking about the points. First of all, really considering the question and making sure they understand it. Then thinking about the keywords. Then I make a big deal about whether they should be drawing a graph or a diagram or anything like that. Then putting in bullet points, and then potentially writing a sort of full answer if they think bullet points don't quite come up to scratch.
Yeah, so I went through it and I found it quite stressful, to be honest. I wasn't sure I'd want to be in that lesson to start with, and I can see why they hate it, because you give them a question. So I'm looking at a picture here. Discuss the energy transfers that take place in the accelerator as the ion passes through it. This is kind of through a question. And then you say 3 marks. You need 3 valid points and you have 1 minute to plan. And I had a vision of you standing there with a stopwatch.
Absolutely.
Is that how it works?
Yeah. And they hate it.
Oh, yeah, stressful. I was thinking, I can't think of 3 things in 1 minute.
But I think that as long as they understand that this is super low stakes, but it will help them in the long run, then if they write 0, then, you know, no one's going to laugh at them. If it all ends up in the bin, it doesn't matter. But it's just, you know, I guess it's a bit like having your first driving lesson on a dodgem. in terms of, yeah, it doesn't matter if they make mistakes, but you make them think about it and think about it quite hard, because it's not something they really do when they are at the moment approaching questions.
Yeah, I really like the fact you make them pause and think, where are the marks? And I kind of informally have done that. I've always said to the kids, there are four marks. You need four ideas to get the point. But I've never taken it that step further, which you, I love this PowerPoint. I mean, there's exercise after exercise, and you can see you would take about a lesson to go through, possibly more actually. But you're saying, here is the question. This is the number of points you need. This is the amount of time you've got. Go. And you've got another thing in there where you say, this stage you think, but this stage you write. And there you ask them to write the key words before they do anything else. So they read the question, they write the key words, and then they write the answer. Is that the approach?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you do see that when GCSE pupils or whatever are doing their mocks, I say, you know, away from the answer section, just write four words or write four super short sentences that you think are the most important bits. And if I see that, then I'm going to heap praise on that child, because it shows me that they've thought and they've come up with a plan. And if they've actually scratched something out and put a fifth point on there, you know, it's another level of planning. And so that's what I'm, yeah, it's that pause, write down your bullet points, and then expand that into an answer. Or pause, write down your bullet points, and decide that a well-labeled diagram will do the job just as well.
Yeah, so I would strongly recommend the dear listener to look at Will's resources, which are linked in the show notes and were last week. I'd like to move on to the other resource that you linked to. That is one you accidentally, you were telling me earlier, you accidentally paste in because you use it a lot. And I just thought we'd give a shout out to Nathaniel Dwyer. Do you want to describe them? I think that I'd never seen them. I think they're brilliant, and I'll definitely use them as well.
Yeah, they're superb. What he's essentially done is he's assembled a bank, both at GCSE and A-level, of probably 20, 30 extended writing questions with mark schemes on the back, which the kids can use as a marking grid. So definitely during the revision period, I spent every single lesson I have with the fifth form starts with them choosing one at Lucky Dip, and the whole class spends 6 minutes writing a five mark response to whatever it is that they choose. And it's a great way. And initially they grumble about it a little bit, but actually when it becomes part of the process, they realize that this is where most marks get dropped. And so where it's a real opportunity to do quite well is by getting good at it.
So you say fifth form, the only one I've seen so far is A-level, so there's actually a whole GCSE bank as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it is fantastic. So what the resource is a question with a place to answer it, and then pin marking, which I'd not heard of, which is praise, improvements, and next steps, which seems like a nice little acronym. But that is very detailed and written for people to mark somebody else's work. So it just looks like an absolutely fantastic resource.
Yeah, and the kids really, they get quite competitive, but they criticize each other, which makes them reflect on their own work as well. And it's great as a wonderful way to spend the 10 minutes at the start of any lesson.
I can believe it. I'll definitely be using it. Funnily enough, my kids asked me today, when will we be doing written answers? They're a bit worried about it. So yeah, so that's an excellent resource. And what I really like, Will, is that you actively teach the skills of answering the questions, which I would say I have been a bit scared of. Just because I don't have a process for it. And I think looking at you, I think you've given me a process here. And certainly this stuff from Nathaniel is given me a massive amount of resource to use to apply that process to. So I think I've got a good starting point.
Great. Well, happy to help. I think it all came about from when at parents' evening, you know, you'd say to parents, oh, you know, we'll do lots of exam technique stuff. And then I found myself thinking, actually, surely there's a better way than just them getting it wrong every time. Might as well do something about it and try and give them a technique. And I think even if it's not the perfect technique, it's a start.
And that's better than they're getting from me at the moment. But this year, it's all going to change. The CBD of the podcast continues. The CBD for Thomas WP continues on the podcast. So what I liked about that is how he explicitly teaches it, which is what you've been saying as well, Carol. He is taking time to say, this is how you write an answer for an A-level question, and this is how you get the marks, and these are the skills you need to develop, which in your classroom would be well developed by the time they start this. And in my classroom, I wouldn't say I'm that explicit, and it's something I certainly can develop. I do prepare them for written answers, but I'm much more, there's 6 points, you need 6 ideas, think of 6 bullet points, then write it down. And that's my sort of level. What about you? How do you do your writing for communication?
When I started teaching, I definitely was, as long as they know the information, give them a question and they'll be able to do it. You know, they just need the knowledge. But over time, I've realized, no, that's not how it works. One thing that's really worth doing is spending time analyzing models and co-constructing success criteria, by which I mean looking at examples of writing for different purposes, whether it be writing out a method for an investigation or an actual long answer to an exam question. What I like to do is to have 1, 2, or 3 examples and start with one that's not very good, which they can obviously see that doesn't answer the question, right? Why doesn't it answer the question? Okay, let's think of things they could do better. Right, let's look at another example. Right, this is a little bit better. Brilliant, have they done all the things that we suggested? Yes, right. And now let's look at the ideal answer that goes above and beyond, is beautiful. It might sometimes even be shorter than the second one, which is something to take note of. What is it that they've done that has made it a fantastic answer? And that then forms the basis of our success criteria for writing. So for instance, I think this is really important to do with investigations. You know, writing a method, that's actually really hard. So I would start with a really rubbish one, and then I would try following it in front of them. And I'd do like a really dramatic teacher demo. So an example I did with year 9 recently was melting ice cubes in different funnels, and we covered them with different materials to see how quickly they would melt. I didn't realize how excited year 9 would get by this. It was amazing. And so my first method was put ice cubes in a funnel and cover it with one of the materials. So you know, I did that and I was like, right, put it in a funnel, cover it with one of the materials, put it in a beaker and leave it for 10 minutes, measure how much water is in there. And you can imagine I kept coming up with problems like, oh, but this isn't staying. Oh, but this, and oh, but they're like, oh, but miss, they might not be the same size. Oh, but okay. So we then started to very quickly see what information was missing and the fact that they wouldn't be able to do exactly the same thing each time. So that then led us to the second method, which had a bit more breaking it down into steps and more precision. How is this an improvement? How could it be improved further? And then the final one, I was asking questions like, which parts of this method are suggesting ways to make your results accurate? Which parts are suggesting ways to make your results precise? Let's color code them so they could see how not just what they're doing, because they might be doing it anyway, but how they're writing about it explains what they're doing and the thinking behind it. Now, you may be thinking, everything that I'm describing so far is kind of metacognition. It's the explicitly teaching students about the thinking and the process and how we're doing things. And I just thought I'd mention that because I think a lot of people can be a bit confused about what metacognition looks like in practice, because it's a bit of a fuzzy term. But that's kind of what I think this is. You're just saying, this is our thinking. This is what we need to do. This is what's going on in my brain whilst I decide what to write. I think that analysis of models and co-constructing success criteria, the reason why I say co-constructing is that if you just give them success criteria, they may not understand what they mean and they may not know what they look like in practice. Whereas by realizing together, oh, we should be doing this, we should be doing that, it just makes a lot of sense to them. They get it. And then another thing that is, I think, really worth doing is, you know, you can have writing frames and structure strips, which can be really good for saying, write paragraph 1, write about this, paragraph 2 about this. But then when you start to remove the scaffolds, you need to think about how you've taught them to work out what those questions and what those paragraphs need to be in the first place. So that's why I actually like to use planning scaffolds. So a bit how Will was describing having this process and these steps, what I tend to do with my students is I get them to take a sheet of A4 in their book and they break it into 4, divide it into like a cross in the middle to have 4 sections. Top left corner, we draw a picture of what's going on. because as physicists, the first step usually is to draw a picture. Okay, we need to try and visualize what's going on. And it might be that we have several pictures because there might be several steps. Second step, like Will does as well, is write the keywords. I say keywords and relationships. Relationships is my word for maths formulae. And then once we've got the keywords and relationships, we look at the question. So say the example, describe and explain the photoelectric effect. So we'll draw a picture and annotated it. We've written down words like threshold frequency, intensity, electrons, metal, surface, equals HF. And then, right, the question is asking for describe and explain. Right, so one of the next boxes, bottom left, is going to be bullet point description, and the other one is going to be explanation. What I'm teaching them to do is write the words in relationships, and then we look at the question, see what it's asking, and we extract the command words, in this case, describe and explain, and we explicitly address each of them in turn. Now, as Will described, this can be a bit of a painful process for students at the beginning. And they're like, miss, this is so long. Do we have to do this? Is this going to be every time? And I'm like, no, we're going to do this until you're just doing this in your head. And it has just elevated their ability to express themselves and crucially to answer the question, because the process involves looking at what the question is asking and all the different parts. So we talk about, okay, well, if it says analyze or describe and explain a graph, what does a description of a graph look like? We need to have looked at examples of that so they know what that means. Explain, how do you know that? Or what's the reason for it? You need to know what that looks like.
So for someone like me, who I have a very tight timeline for my A-level, and I'm slightly nervous about starting this because I think it will take ages, and I hear what you're saying, some of those things you're saying, I can imagine not getting very far down the route in an hour lesson. What you're saying is it's worth that investing, because do it two or three times and then it becomes second nature and then off they go.
Absolutely. And I think what I'd say as well, the difference between this and writing for learning is writing for learning, you do as you teach the new idea as part of structuring their understanding. Whereas you do this when they know the stuff and they just need to organise their writing. So this doesn't take as long.
What's really had resonance with me, and I realise that this is why I love talking to you, Carol, because you have these epiphany moments. The scaffolding that I give them has to be explicit. Otherwise, when you take it away, they're completely bereft because they've no idea what you've done. I'm setting it up like this because when you're on your own, you will also set it up like this, but you'll just do it unconsciously in your own head because you've practiced it loads of times. It's a relatively quick mental leap, but it is something that I just realise I'm not doing enough of.
And I think, you know, to the point about, oh, this is going to take a while, it makes such a difference for students who might have low prior attainment. So if you've got students who are doing really well, maybe this won't make a big difference. My first school that I taught in, all of my students were eligible for free school meals in my A-level class, and a lot of them had English as a second language. And the reason they liked physics partly was because of the maths. That wasn't difficult for them. They could do that. But the writing they found incredibly hard. Just the look in some of their eyes when they created writing based on this process and saw that they could do it, it gives me goosebumps. They were like, oh my God, I can do this, miss. And even in the exams, you know, I had, bless them, some of my, you know, A-level physicists come to me afterwards, be like, miss, I did the thing, I did the picture, and I did the keywords on the side, like you said, and I could write it, I wrote about it. They were really proud of themselves. And so you do have to think a little bit about, is this going to be a good use of time for your students? This is very similar to how I might approach maths and problem solving. Going, okay, here's a question. What's it asking about in terms of physics principles? Not in terms of, oh, is it a pulley? Is it a tension? Is it mass? Is it a slope, an inclined plane? What's the underlying principle? Is it asking me to describe, explain, analyze? I think there's a little bit of a similarity there that you can apply to mathematical questions too.
What you just said, of course, is so resonant in the sense that it's a real source of frustration. I mean, particularly at A-level, in GCSE, they almost pander to this, but at A-level, it's this kind of idea that there's a maths question and then there's a physics question. It's like, no, that's missing the point. These things are inherently linked, and you can't understand one without the other, because otherwise you're just doing maths problems, and that's not quite physics for me. And like I say, GCSE, they play up to that, but I think that's a bit more understandable there. But at A-level, I feel it's something that's important to distinguish. Loads and loads of brilliant ideas, but I am also very conscious of time. Well worth every minute. Thank you for giving us a taste of this. I suspect this will be an episode that will be listened to again and again by people wanting to hear about how to embed literacy. And we started very naively from the point of view, I think Thomas and I are thinking this is how to answer exam questions, but now we know it's so much more, and this is really empowering stuff. So thank you so much.
You're most welcome. I'm going to try and write up a little blog post summarizing some of this so that people can also see examples of student works. I think that really helps to see how to put into practice. So I'll send you a link to that when that's done as well.
Yes, thank you, Carol. I mean, my CPD, as I said earlier, just continues. I feel this is an area I can greatly improve on, and I shall report back in a few months, Robin.
I would just add one thing I'm trying to develop in my practice is oracy, speaking and listening. So I'm still learning, and I'm excited to see how that can develop my practice too as well.
Isn't that the best thing about teaching? You never stop learning. It's always something new, always something interesting, always something to explore.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Carol. It's been an absolute pleasure once more.
Lovely to see you both.
And thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Thomas. Catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks this week to Carol Kenrick. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas W.P., with Robin Griffiths. And produced and edited this week by Robin, with me doing the show notes. Who knew? Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.